break out the Best New Podcast Awards. It's time for Pretentious, a podcast about the albums and artists that have shaped the last decade of indie music culture as chosen by Pitchfork Media. I'm Trevor Ickrath.
And I'm Dylan Flynn. And I'm excited.
I'm excited too, Dylan.
I love this kind of shit, man. I love this kind of looking at culture through media shit. It's my kind of shit.
I think it's fair to say that you and I both have what could be described as like a love-hate relationship with music journalism.
Definitely.
And particularly the website we're going to be talking about on this show, Pitchfork Media.
I'm so glad we're starting there, right? So this is a podcast, of course, where you and I are looking back at albums that received the Best New Music Award 10 years after their release to just kind of see what those albums are like now, what they were at the time, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm anticipating I'm going to spend a lot of this podcast feeling old as fuck.
I'm done. I don't care. I tell people I'm 65 now. I don't care.
I feel it.
But the thing that when you first approached me with this idea, Trevor, I thought, oh, it's too bad that we're not doing like 20 years because that's, you know, was truly the golden era of blog music. You know,
that was really when Pitchfork was kind of making a name for itself, wasn't it?
But I've come to be kind of happier that we're doing this, that we're looking at the decay of an orbit rather than it's at its highest powers.
Sure. I mean, I feel like there's definitely something appealing about looking at an institution like Pitchfork once it's kind of arrived and kind of, like you said, on its way down. I don't know if I'd say Pitchfork has declined too much from its heyday.
It certainly changed its position in our culture.
Definitely. Yeah, I would agree with that.
And I'm so glad that we're doing this, and I do want to kind of like, because I've been thinking about this so much, and it's really brought me to something that I realized about like why Pitchfork makes me uncomfortable, why the idea of Pitchfork makes me uncomfortable. I think I finally cracked it, Trevor.
Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Okay, so here's the problem when you have a music outlet, a journalism outlet that is seen as an arbiter of taste, as the score that everybody's looking to. I would say right now it's probably the closest thing we have to it is Fantano. Would you say that holds for you?
Yeah, I don't really keep up with his reviews the same way I did back when I was an avid Pitchfork reader, but I do know that he is quite the tastemaker when it comes to like the more recent generation of music nerds, specifically those on sites like Reddit and Twitter.
But the thing that I think I rebel against in my body, in my very soul, at the idea of taste making from a single review source is something that's happened to me, maybe not lately, but certainly when I was younger, and I think it happens to a lot of people, which is that a new album comes out and you listen to it and you think, this is really cool. But you're a person who's looking to that arbiter review to say like, but is it really cool? Is it really cool? Am I allowed to tell my friends that I like it? And then the review drops, and let's say they kind of stick their nose up and they kind of say, nah, no good, no good. Well, maybe you don't hate that record now, but you probably changed your relationship with that record now. And that, to me, is one of the evilest forms of writing in the world, because it's literally robbing joy out of people's lives.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I really thought I liked this.
And it turns out, no, I can't. I don't really. I thought it was not as good as I thought, which is such a fucking... Even the best music journalism, like where the prose is great, the take is interesting, maybe they use it as a launch point for like a grander essay about the culture. Even the best album review takes a whole lot less time, care, and effort to make than the worst album. The fact that like that somebody can just sit at their computer and say like, meh, 6.5, and now somebody's like, ooh, I can't like this. That's what makes me uncomfortable about Pitchfork, about tastemaker journalism, arbiter of taste journalism. And so that's probably the baggage that I carry into this, but I don't want to have like a chip on my shoulder, really.
I totally agree with you. And I think over the past couple years in particular, Pitchfork has kind of shifted away from devoting their reviews to talking about whether something is good or not to doing more like what you said, where they're posting these kind of essays that just use the album in question as a springboard to talk about something much bigger, particularly with her like Classic Sunday reviews, I think.
And I'm not against that kind of journalism, that kind of music criticism. I definitely think that like your results may vary. It all comes down to the quality of writing in that, in those cases. You know what I mean? I tend to avoid music reviews as a rule, and Pitchfork ones especially. I do still go to Pitchfork a lot. It's my preferred music news outlet because I think that their news feed is like ideal for me. I love that there's no snark in their news copy, and I personally love that it's like one of the only websites I go to where there are no comment sections and nobody is there.
That's something I've always actually really wanted, a Pitchfork comment section, because you gotta imagine that would be a real jungle.
I just feel like I can never get away from them, you know? I feel like I'm always inundated with stranger opinions, and I fucking had enough of them.
I remember having some pretty good times back in the Stereo Gum comment sections back in the day.
I don't think I've ever posted, but I have read Stereo Gum comment sections, and I guess I would say that the times that I've had doing that could be construed as good, I suppose. So then that brings us to episode one, right? What came out 10 years ago?
Yeah, today for our first episode, we're going to be going all the way back to August 2010. And Dylan, I was hoping something that we could do for every episode is I was hoping that you could provide me with a little trivia about what was going on this month 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Let me crack the knuckles and take us back 10 years to August 2nd, 2010. In the news, Obama announced that he will end the Iraq war, withdrawing U.S. combat troops. The number one movie in America was Inception, and the nation said happy birthday to Clerks director Kevin Smith, who turned 40.
Big month for film bros, and particularly New Jersey film bros.
Yeah, right? For sure. Inception, man. I remember going to see it opening weekend.
Definitely, me too. Yeah, I mean, I still remember hearing those big bong noises playing from those movie theater speakers for the first time.
Do you remember hearing the sounds of Arcade Fire coming out of your stereo?
I do, because it was in this month that Arcade Fire released their seminal album, The Suburbs.
I'm so glad that this is the first one we're doing. It really feels like a big place marker in the era of blog rock.
It feels like a right place to start, definitely. I mean, we're starting a little too late in the year to cover some other 2010 classics like Contra by Vampire Weekend or This Is Happening by LCD Sound System. But when it comes to a podcast about the last 10 years of Pitchfork and blog rock in general, yeah, I mean, you can't really find a better starting place than The Suburbs by Arcade Fire.
Oh, for sure. Like, if there was a subgenre of music, and thank God that there isn't, but if there was a subgenre of music that people called, like, Pitchfork Core, Arcade Fire is their Beatles. They're, like, the biggest blog rock band in history, aren't they?
Their name is practically synonymous with Pitchforks.
This album, too, I guess we'll kind of get to it, but it feels like a real tide shift moment, too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it was definitely a big moment for the culture, which I'm saying there with a capital C.
Great.
But Dylan, what do you remember about the release of The Suburbs? What do you remember thinking about it when it came out? What do you think about Arcade Fire overall?
So, Arcade Fire, I remember I probably would have ranked them as like one of my five favorite bands back in 2004, 2005. I remember saying things in high school like, there are generations Radiohead. That's something I definitely said out loud with my human mouth. And then based on their subsequent releases, I don't think that they'd ever come close to like a really top spot in a personal heat ranking of like bands and artists that I like. But I've always paid attention to an extent, and I've liked most of what they've done. And I still do see them as like a prestige artist, for better or for worse. that's still where they're filed away in my brain, at least. And Funeral was such a big record that, like, kind of unavoidable culturally.
So it's fair to say you've, like, been a pretty big fan of them throughout their career.
For sure, for sure. What about you? Do you remember, like, were you even kind of online when Funeral was having its moment culturally?
I missed Funeral, actually. The first Arcade Fire album that I checked out was Neon Bible, and then I worked my way back from there. But you said Radiohead would be a good point of comparison. I've actually always seen Arcade Fire as our generation's U2, as this, like, big, frequently super serious band that isn't really afraid to kind of make itself look a little, to quote the name of the show, pretentious in reaching for these big emotions and big statements.
And having a sound that would translate pretty easily to a stadium setting.
Mm-hmm. And like you too, it feels like they have kind of fallen in and out of favor with the public at large as their career has gone on. And we've also seen them shift between multiple different kind of styles and personas, which we'll talk a little bit about later.
I think it's an apt comparison, and there are quite a few parallels, actually, between U2 and Arcade Fire. So, gold star. Gold star to Trevor Rickrath.
I remember this album coming out pretty distinctly, too. It was, like, you know, the end of summer 2010. I was just about to start my second year of college, I think, so I was listening to a lot of indie rock, reading a lot of Pitchfork. This album came out. I remember not loving it, but I did think it was like a solid release and better than Neon Bible, although it didn't touch Funeral for me. And that's pretty much how I still feel about it. I would say it's probably my second favorite Arcade Fire album.
I would agree with that ranking, and I don't think I would disagree with anything you said, but it was pretty different, Trevor, going back to this record for this show to me, because I hadn't really listened to it much in the intervening years since the release. And I had a very different experience with it, the way that I emotionally reacted to it than I did at the time.
Yeah, you told me that you liked it better going backwards from 2020 than moving forwards from 2004. And I gotta say, I would probably agree. And maybe some of that is due to the fact that I feel like we don't really get as many albums like this anymore.
That's like a big part of it.
Like Arcade Fire and a lot of their like graduating class, if you will, has kind of like faded in renown a little bit, and their albums don't really feel like as big events as they used to.
Yeah, I almost didn't notice when that last one came out. And the other thing that changed for me, Trevor, is I feel like coming at the suburbs, having like lived through Funeral and then been enjoyed but not being blown away by Neon Bible, I was still kind of like sitting down with this record of like, what if they did it again? What if they made another zeitgeist-capturing, generation-defining masterpiece? And then my experience with it was like, well, they didn't, but this is a good record. Whereas opposed to, like, going back to it, I know for sure now that the Arcade Fire is never going to pull that off again. That's never going to happen.
I disagree, because if you look at a band like U2, like I said, they fell in and out of favor throughout their entire career, where like sometimes they were the hottest band in the world, and then they'd kind of push their luck a little too much, and they would hit a career nadir before eventually coming back with like another big album. So I don't know if I would be surprised if we get another like sensational album from Arcade Fire again in the future.
I think they could definitely have a return to form. I think suffice it to say that there would need to be pretty major shifts to our cultural landscape for an Arcade Fire to like explode in the pop culture landscape the way that it could have back then.
We're getting ahead of ourselves, though, I think.
We are. But I will say that, like, coming at it from 2020, just accepting the fact that, like, okay, well, this is the body of work. Maybe they got something coming down the pipeline, but I kind of know what the Arcade Fire are now, high and low. My takeaway was just like, fuck, man, this is a solid-ass record. It's like, good, you know, artistically high-minded pop rock music with big hooks, big ideas, and maybe the themes were like taken a little bit more at face value seriousness at the time of like the poetry of mundanity and the suburbs and the culture, whereas now that stuff maybe seems a little bit unimportant based on how all of our kind of, you know, priorities have shifted. But it's still good writing. It's still strong performance. I think the production is quite good. And I just feel like, what a solid effort. What a solid effort to put out an album that is by no means short, but stays with you quality-wise pretty much the whole way through. And if you're a person who's looking for a good Arcade Fire album, you certainly cannot fucking go wrong with The Suburbs. It's a great record.
A lot of people tell you you could do a lot worse than The Suburbs when it comes to Arcade Fire albums.
You sure could. You sure could.
Let's talk about the rest of this band's records, though, and their kind of history overall, because I think a fun thing to do would be to take a deeper dive into the band that made this record before we kind of get to talking about it.
Let's get to know these boys and girls, these guys and gals, and their story.
So Arcade Fire originally formed in 2001 when two college students from Montreal, Wynn Butler and Josh Dew, who'd been friends since high school, decided to start a band together. They soon invited one of Wynn's classmates, a music student named Regine Chassonnier, who would later marry Wynn, to join them, after which they recorded a set of demos and began playing live.
And they brought out a bunch of new members, and their local popularity started to grow and get some attention. They got multi-instrumentalist Tim Kyle, who
later of Wild Light.
Yes, of course. Bassist Miles Brosco.
Later of Crystal Cliffs and AIDS Wolf.
God, there's a whole genre of like embarrassingly named blog rock bands too.
A lot of them have Wolf in the title too.
A lot of them did. Crystal, Wolf, so many of them.
Yeah.
Guitarist, drummer, Dane Mills. I don't know what he got up to afterwards.
He was in a band called Crackpot.
Don't even know them. And another multi-instrumentalist, Brendan Reed.
Who went on to become a founding member of Clues.
Exactly. But that lineup didn't last very long, Trevor.
No, it quickly dissolved over the next year and a half while they recorded their first self-titled EP over the summer of 2002. Allegedly, tensions between Wynn and Miles led the latter to quit the band, only to be replaced by Richard Parry, who was a multi-instrumentalist they'd been working with on those early recording sessions. And around that time, Josh Dew left the band to resume his studies, although he did continue to collaborate on the visual aspects of the band.
And it's kind of a pattern, right? Because then they were doing a show to celebrate the release of that EP, and then Brendan Reed and Wynn got into like a fight on stage, and then
Loved to have seen this.
It's so great. And then Reed like quit the band in the middle of the encore. That's fucking rock and roll, man.
Just probably then, like flung his tambourine at Wynn. He's like, man, I'm out.
And then if you had any illusions about who was in the right in that fight, as soon as the show was over, Dane Mills also exited the group. So yeah, Wynn Butler.
I really get the impression Wynn is like a polarizing dude. Like, it sounds like based on these early days, if you're in a band with him, you're either going to end up butting heads and leaving the band, or you're going to end up marrying him and having his children.
It's like if you're a band leader who's got a lot of vision and a lot of passion and want to have a lot of control over the output, you become kind of a cult leader, right? Isn't that how it always sort of goes? So I could see just like on paper, Wynn's behavior to his bandmates was probably fucking atrocious because he just like wanted them to do what he wanted them to do. You know what I mean?
I know that Wynn is allegedly quite the basketball player. Maybe they were shit talking his free throws or something. Anyways, following that onstage implosion, the remaining members of Arcade Fire replaced Reed and Mills with Wynn's brother William and bassist guitarist Tim Kingsbury before hiring drummer Howard Beilerman the following summer. And soon after that, that lineup was signed to Merge Records based on the strength of some of their early live shows. And once they'd been signed, Arcade Fire began work on their first LP, Funeral.
Okay, if you're one of these dudes who quit because Wynn was being an overbearing dick or whatever, do you now look back with regret and shame that you, like, jumped off of a comet just before it fucking went, like, supernova?
Something I always think about. You know, who's that guy from Metallica that they kicked out right before they got really big and he went on to go join Megadeth?
Dave Mustaine.
Apparently Dave Mustaine rues it every single waking moment of his life.
Yeah, even though he's like the number two biggest thrash metal band, he still can't gank it over it.
Would being in the number two thrash metal band be big enough for you, Dylan?
Yeah, sure. I
don't know if I'd settle for that.
I don't really have that drive in me, I guess, the Dave Mustaine drive. So Funeral. Let's talk about Funeral, because, I mean, come on. It's the high watermark of something.
One of the big indie rock classics, like alongside, I would probably say, like In the Airplane Over the Sea or something like that.
It kind of feels like the linchpin of an argument, and a hypothetical argument that you or I might have with the younger generation coming up from behind us to say, like, no, the music we thought was cool when we were young was important and good and should be respected, as opposed to, like, yeah, I know some of it was kind of fucking weird and silly and elitist and dumb, you know?
Yeah. Well, most of this record was recorded over the course of 1 week in August 2003 for around $10,000, and it was given its title because several band members had recently lost members of their families. Like, Regine's grandmother died in June 2003, Wynn and Will's grandfather died in 2004, and I believe a couple of Richard Perry's aunts also died that year.
Death surrounds the Arcade Fire. The album was released in the U.S. and in Canada in September of 2004, and then soon after it received that legendary 9.7 score from Pitchfork. They gave it a Best New Music nod, and contributing writer David Moore said that Funeral evokes sickness and death, but also understanding and renewal, childlike mystification, but also the impending coldness of maturity. That's a little tangly prose, but I get what he's getting at. Those are themes on that record.
Did you go back and read that review in preparation for this episode? Because the whole thing is pretty tangly.
It's 2004 Pitchfork writing. It's very.
It barely reads like a music review.
It's a little wild. But I get what in that pull quote, at least, what he's getting at. And I also think that childlike thing was a big part of the appeal. It kind of made people in their 20s think about being 13 again in a romantic and nostalgic way.
I think the band kind of got saddled with that reputation. And in a way, it eventually ended up with them being featured prominently on the soundtrack for that Where the Wild Things Are film adaptation. Remember that?
Yeah. That big wake-up pull, right?
It was like Arcade Fire the movie.
And the other big sonic element of that record that you were hearing fucking everywhere was that drum pattern from, which one is it, Neighborhood 3? The do, ka, ka, do.
Oh, yeah, Power Out, right?
Yeah, yep. was everywhere. It just sort of suddenly it was in the grammar of indie rock and everybody was using it. So that, obviously, that review of the album, Trevor, is seen as, like, one of the big deciding moments that launched Arcade Fire into the stratosphere.
Oh, yeah, and people were even talking about it as such, like, back in the day. Like, in an Observer article from November 2004, writer Hilary Frey discussed that review's impact with Dan Hoogland, a manager of Other Music, a popular record store in New York City's East Village, who claimed that it was, like, impossible to find a copy of the album in New York after the Pitchfork review was published. Apparently, after the Pitchfork review, Merge had to release, like, an additional 60,000 copies of Funeral to meet the increase in demand.
I found it around that time. I remember my friend Mike Knockstead taking me to Everyday Music in Portland, Oregon, and putting the record in my hand and saying, like, take this home and listen to it. It's important. And also, it wasn't just Pitchfork. I mean, Funeral appeared in the top 10 album lists for 2004 and 2005 in a lot of different review outlets. Filter, No Ripcord, the MTV2 2005 review crowned it the album of the year. NME called Funeral second in their list of 2005's best albums. And then by November of 2005, Funeral had gone gold in both Canada and the UK and sold over 500,000 copies worldwide, which is an enormous number for an independent release with like, you know, minimal mainstream radio or television exposure. You have to realize, like, the idea of a blog hit kind of didn't exist the way that we think about it now. This was like infrastructure was being built by this release.
Yeah, this really kind of paved the way for that kind of specific brand of success. It even became Merge Records' first album on the Billboard 200 chart and the label's biggest selling album to date, surpassing Neutral Milk Hotels in the airplane over the sea.
Maybe we'll get to that one on like a classic Sunday episode.
That would be fun. But yeah, the success of this album really brought Arcade Fire to new heights. Like over the next 2 years, they appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman. They appeared on later with Jules Holland. They played a couple concerts with David Bowie. They opened for U2. And in 2006, they were nominated for a Best Alternative Rock Album Grammy, which they unfortunately lost to Get Behind Me, Satan by the White Stripes.
Ooh, Get Thee Behind Me, Jack White. Only they couldn't.
But in 2009, Funeral was named the second best album of the aughts by none other than Pitchfork itself, who were still big fans of the album 5 years later.
Yeah, man. It still feels like one of the defining releases of that whole decade. At least it does to me, an old-ass white dude.
It's a classic.
Okay, so then you got the follow-up. What a difficult record to follow up, Trevor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how do you, like, follow up a phenomenon like Funeral?
Well, here's how they did it. Between the release of Funeral and the beginning of the recording sessions for their next record, the band purchased a defunct church. This was, like, a huge, huge talking point at the time, in the small Quebec town of Farnham, and they spent the early part of 2006 converting it into a recording studio, which is where they would record the bulk of their second album called, Trevor,
Neon Bible. And, you know, a big thing you got to understand about mid-2000s indie rock bands is these guys loved recording in defunct churches. I think this was also a big thing for the Decemberists, if I recall correctly. I'm sure there are others that I just can't think of right now, but it was a thing.
Yeah, and just the idea of a non-conventional recording environment in general was really coming back into fashion.
Neon Bible, though, what do you think about this one? Because like I said earlier, definitely a step down from Funeral, but I listened to it a couple times prepping for this episode, and I think it still holds up as a pretty solid record.
I think the writing is really solid, and the songwriting is really solid. I don't love the sound of the record, though. The production of it feels a little kind of washy to me. Like my 2020 ears are saying, maybe you shouldn't have fucking bought that church, guys. Maybe you should have gone into a booth and, you know, hired a new producer, gotten those drums sounding a little crisper. There's just something that's a little washy sounding about it.
A little too much reverb, but it ends up sounding a little muddy, I think.
Yeah, but they are, I mean, like, it's not a step down in terms of these guys still know how to write tunes. They still know how to write hooks. There's some indisputable classic Arcade Fire material on that record. Of course, No Cars Go, I think, has become one of the big touchstones for the band, as well as the title track as well.
And Black Mirror, which they named that dystopian sci-fi Netflix show after, right?
What if phones, but too much, Trevor?
Anyway, like Funeral, this album was a pretty big success for Arcade Fire. It reached number 2 on the US Billboard Top 200 charts and the UK Top 40 album chart. It was also number 1 on the rock and indie album charts. And the first proper single, Black Mirror, reached the number 1 spot on CBC Radio 3's R330 chart for 5 consecutive weeks from March 22nd to April 19th, 2007.
And, of course, the critics were still very much in the pocket. A lot of acclaim. The British magazine Q proclaimed the Arcade Fire as, quote, the most exciting act on the earth, Trevor. Paste called it one of the 5 best albums of 2007. Trouser Press writer Jason Rear ranked Neon Bible among the best indie rock recordings of all time. Pitchfork, however, was not necessarily treating them like their golden boys. Maybe they helped launch the Arcade Fire, but they weren't going to give them a free pass. They still gave Neon Bible Best New Music, but they gave it a more tepid rating of an 8.4, and it did not even crack the top 25 on their best albums of 2007 that year, winding up at number 27 on that list.
Right. I was looking through that Pitchfork review as to prep for this episode, and one line that stood out to me was, Unlike the cathartic funeral, Neon Bible operates on spring-loaded tension and measured release. As such, it could strike some listeners as a disappointing follow-up, but the record's mix of newfound discipline and passion will likely imbue it with a long shelf life, which, like I said, I feel like it has held up over these years, even though it wasn't really super exciting at the time.
I still hear people advocate for it hard, but they tend to talk about it as like an underrated pick. Mm-hmm. They're like, you shouldn't sleep on Neon Bible. Neon Bible is really good. And I'll give it to them.
It did get the band their second nomination for that Best Alternative Rock Album Grammy in 2008, although they did lose again to the White Stripes. Again.
Oof.
Jack White, you can't beat him.
Or Meg. She's a powerhouse. So after a successful tour in support of Neon Bible and another few high-profile live performances over the next couple of years, including an unforgettable performance at the Obama campaign staff ball alongside Jay-Z in 2009, at the president's personal request, Trevor, the band began to work on their third album, which eventually released in August 2010, and of course is called The Suburbs.
The album we're here to talk about today.
All right, so let's do some overview stuff. We talked about some of this already, but let's just keep in mind like what a juggernaut success this was. It peaked at number one on the Billboard album sales chart. It sold over 1 million copies worldwide and is to date the band's best-selling record. It was certified gold in the U.S., platinum in the U.K., and 2x platinum in Canada. So now officially, the Arcade Fire are a mainstream rock machine.
Right, and things will get more mainstream in just a second, but first let's talk about this album. It was recorded primarily in Win and Regine's home in Montreal, although some parts were recorded at the band's studio in Quebec and in New York City, and it was produced by Marcus Draves, who had worked with the band on Neon Bible.
Yeah, Marcus kind of stays around too after this, although his role becomes reduced more and more over time. Mm-hmm. And then around the time of the album's release, Wynn Butler described the record's overall sound as a mix of Depeche Mode and Neil Young. He also said that he wanted the album to sound like the bands I heard when I was very young and wondered what those crazy noises were.
Right, and he described the lyrical content by saying that it was inspired by his and Will's upbringing in the suburbs of Houston, Texas. He said that the album is neither a love letter to nor an indictment of the suburbs. It's a letter from the suburbs.
I guess that checks out.
Yeah, and they unveiled the album at the end of May 2010 alongside a release of a double-sided 12-inch single containing the title track and another new song from the record, Month of May.
And then The Suburbs, as I said, went on to debut at number one on the Billboard 200. It sold 156,000 copies in the first week. And I think now is a good time for us to look at like what the reception was like at the time, Trevor, across kind of music journalism in general.
Sure, yeah. You've assembled a couple little statistics here that we'll go through.
Average review score of 87 out of 100 based on 43 critics on Metascore. That is a
user score of 8.9.
Yeah, and that's considered universal acclaim on that website. Prefix Magazine gave it a 9.5 out of 10 and said, Arcade Fire, because they're really this damn good, are among the very few indie bands that could pull it off completely. At this point, they have no competition but themselves. No other band is this bold, this daring. As long as Arcade Fire is making records, the music world is a better place. Good God.
That's not the same outlet that called them the most exciting band on the planet or whatever for Neon Bible, was it?
That is fervent. That is fervent. I think it's two different journalists, though.
Music journalists do like their hyperbole.
I'd really love you to read this quote, Trevor, from Matthew Bennett of Clash Magazine, who gave the album a 9 out of 10.
Matthew Bennett said, every song presents memories in glorious translucence. Familiarity mingles with the fear of the unknown, whilst the decaying urban facade becomes a shifting canvas upon which they batter their rhythmic tails. That's like the exact kind of stuff I don't like about music journalism. Like, I'll always appreciate a good record review and like the way it can bring insight to a record and help me appreciate it in a whole new way, but that kind of stuff really just sours me on like the entire medium.
Definitely cannot picture myself sitting at a MacBook writing the phrase rhythmic tails and thinking, I'm going to send this to my editor.
Yeah.
Okay, so there were some talking points, Trevor, because I read every existing review for this record on Metacritic, and I noticed a lot of patterns. And I wanted to share some of them with you, things that come up in a lot of different reviews of this record.
Which is a thing you'll often see with, like, big albums like this. There are definitely, they, like, all these reviews kind of boil down to, like, four or five singular takes.
I'm a big believer in the concept of collective intelligence. So when I hear that, like, you've gone through all of the reviews and these are the things everyone says, I tend to look at this kind of information as being maybe a little bit more, like, truthful or legitimate than just any individual critic's espousing of opinions, right? Okay, right. So... They tend to say it's better than Neon Bible, but not Funeral.
Check.
They tend to say it's long.
It's true.
Win Butler talks about the kids a lot and also just says that phrase, the kids, a lot.
I do remember him mentioning them pretty frequently.
Sprawl 2 is very good, and Sprawl 1 is not as good.
Sprawl 2 is a big favorite from this record for a lot of people, I know that.
And this sounds like, you know, the ones that recommend it if you like, or the references that come up a lot. Bruce Springsteen comes up, Depeche Mode comes up, and also specifically Daydream Nation, the record from Sonic Youth, comes up.
Interesting. I don't know if I would have reached for that as a point of comparison.
I don't know. I think this stuff is maybe a little bit more immediate in its sort of... overtures to make you sort of dance and sing along than that record is.
A little smoother.
So yeah, it, obviously the general consensus was like, important record, big band. And
Pitchfork liked this one too. They gave The Suburbs another Best New Music, an 8.6, and they also gave one of its songs, Sprawl 2, the site's Best New Track designator.
Let's talk about this review, because I've read it a few times now.
Are you as excited as I am that our first review that we're going to be touching on the show was written by Ian Cohen?
I mean, excited? I think it's fun. I definitely think it's fun.
Probably my favorite Pitchfork writer. I've always been a big fan of, like, emo music, and he's kind of their resident emo guy, so I've often found myself, like, clashing with Ian Cohen's takes on things.
I think this is a pretty fucking good review, though, man.
Oh, I think he nailed it. I mean... Back in 2010, getting an Arcade Fire album slid across your desk at Pitchfork must have been a huge responsibility, and I think he totally rose to the occasion.
And I'm not bending over backwards to applaud any Pitchfork review, but I think it's good. I think it's very meat and potatoes. I think it's got good economy of language. The prose is really solid. And I think that it does a good job looking at the themes in a very literal way and explaining why they work and why they're executed well.
A lot of the review is devoted to talking about how it's a satisfying return to form after Neon Bible's overblown arrangements and pedantic political statements. He compares the album to The River by Bruce Springsteen, which really checks out for me. Both of those albums kind of take the same melancholic approach to, like, getting older and settling down. And he also described the record as a generally paced collection of meditations on familial responsibility, private disappointments, and fleeting youth, which also reintroduces much-needed levity to an act that can be overbearingly self-serious.
I think that's a really good point, and I do think that this album does strike a good balance between kind of looking at something for how ridiculous it is, but also treating it with respect. And I think that we should definitely go ahead and say, like, Springsteen comes up a lot, because Springsteen is clearly the spirit animal of this band, right?
As the podcast's resident host from New Jersey, I can confirm this.
Even back in Funeral, people were making the connection. I mean, it's clear that there's a brand of kind of working class storytelling that really, really wormed its way into the brain of a Win Butler.
But my favorite thing that Ian Cohen does in this review is probably the way he ties the themes that the band explores on The Suburbs all the way back to the stuff they were singing about back on Funeral. Like, he talked about how the initial fantasy of Funeral was escaping the neighborhood, dancing beneath the police lights, and living on misbehavior. The Suburbs can be seen as the update decades later, with those same kids having kids of their own and moving back to and struggling in the same neighborhoods.
Yeah, and here's where I think that maybe we start to get to a point where this stuff reads a little different in 2020 than it did in 2010, just in the terms of, like, do we accept the idea of a quiet, tragic protagonist in the form of, like, a fucking trust fund baby who gets to live in a nice house, you know? Like, are we necessarily buying into the thesis here that there is, like, a Thoreauian nobility to the quiet life of the suburbs?
I don't know, but I think in 2010 we were into it. And I think a big reason why this record was like so popular among music journalists in the time, you got to assume a lot of those writers were probably in their early 20s when Funeral came out, and they were looking for something like that at the time. Flash forward to the suburbs, those same guys are like kind of starting to settle down and have like settled into jobs and they're starting families. Maybe some of them are moving into the suburbs themselves. Here comes like a band that really emotionally resonated with them in the past with a new statement that kind of applies to where they're at in their lives now. I think like you're definitely going to see a lot of positive reactions from that group.
Yeah, their themes were kind of tracking with the rhythms of the North American hipster's life cycle, if you will.
Many of them grew up with this band.
Yeah, for sure. I would probably say that I would call this a band that was important to me in a formative way when I was a young person. Yeah. So I get it. I get it. Okay, so we're giving that review a thumbs up, in my opinion, right? That's a good review of this record.
One of the better Pitchfork reviews I can think of off the top of my head.
I think it's the best review of the suburbs that I read. So, hey, Pitchfork, so far so good.
Way to go, Ian Cohen.
So on August 5th, the Arcade Fire celebrated the release of the suburbs with a live-streamed concert from Madison Square Garden via YouTube. Feels like a very early adopter of that kind of shit, too.
Do you remember this happening? Because I remembered very specifically, and like you said, yeah, I remember this happening a couple times over the course of the 2010s, but this is the first time I remember it happening. Like a band that's a big hollowed band like Arcade Fire about to put out their first new album in a while. They kind of time it to debut alongside a big live stream concert.
So I remember this happening. I also remember that my laptop screen was broken at the time and I didn't have a smartphone. So I didn't really have an option to watch along with the people.
I definitely remember watching it on my laptop in my mom's house.
Sick. It was that, interestingly enough, that concert was filmed and directed by Terry Gilliam of like Brazil and Time Bandits and Monty Python fame.
He brought like a fun touch to it. I remember this opening segment where him and some stagehands go backstage right before the show begins and Arcade Fire are all standing there slumped over with some big wind-up cranks in their back. And what they did was they wound up the band, and then they all kind of came to life and then took to the stage.
Very Gilliam me, for sure.
Very Gilliam, yeah.
And it also included some opening performances by Texas indie rock band Spoon and Canadian violinist Owen Pallett, the latter of whom contributed string arrangements on each of Arcade Fire's three albums thus far, and was also, both of those acts, of course, were like rising darlings of indie rock.
Oh, yeah.
And then later in August of 2010, Arcade Fire teamed up with Google to release an interactive music video for one of the singles from the suburbs, We Used to Wait.
I remember this happening too, and I remember just kind of bouncing off of it. Like, I was not as excited about this as I was about the live stream concert.
It felt a lot more like a corporate-y thing to me than than the first thing, right?
The video was written and directed by Chris Milk. It was produced by BeReal, and it allowed the viewer to enter the address where they grew up and, quote, geo-personalize the video, which set the song to footage provided by Google Maps. I do remember doing it. I put it in the street where I lived and, like, watched it kind of flash by as the song played, feeling nothing really at all about it.
It's kind of like the precursor to those cursed videos that Facebook makes of your memories, you know?
Yes, like, that's exactly what it was like.
Pictures of your exes and like friends you don't talk to anymore at a time, and like a picture that where you look like a fucking idiot at a party, and then it plays some kind of snapping, clapping ukulele music underneath it. It's the same feeling as this Arcade Fire video.
Rolling Stone was a pretty big fan, though. They declared the music video to be one of the year's best, and a year later, Time Magazine named it one of the 30 best music videos of all time.
I would defy you to sit any music journalist down in 2020 in a room and have them freestyle the best music videos of all time and see if they mention that video. Just see.
I doubt it. I feel like the biggest thing, the biggest part of this album's legacy is still to come, though, because we got to talk about how in February 2011, it was again nominated for a Grammy, not just best alternative rock album or whatever, but just like best album full stop that year, I believe.
And it seemed like one of those classic, you know, oh, look, it's 15 people who are on E and also these weirdos and they'll never win.
Yeah, Arcade Fire was up against Eminem, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, and Lady Antebellum, who I believe are just called Lady A now.
Yeah, contentiously, because they stole the name from another artist.
Yeah. But against all odds, Arcade Fire beat out all of those super popular acts, and The Suburbs won the Best Album Grammy that year.
It's hard not to see that moment as kind of the peak of Arcade Fire's cultural penetration, right? Of like, it almost, you almost see two diverging paths, one where to this day, this form of music, this like nerdy college students love it, is like a vital industry, you know?
Yeah, the Grammy win is definitely something I have mixed feelings about, and something that I had mixed feelings about at the time, too, I remember. Because on one hand, while it was very personally gratifying to see a band so representative of a genre of music and a scene that I was like super invested in beat out acts like Eminem and Lady Gaga to take home this big award, on the other hand, it feels like this was the moment where indie kind of blew up and turned into something bigger than a music scene that belonged to just like me and my friends. And it kind of hurt to lose that, you know?
Sure. But, you know, I think it's that impulse that maybe I also felt, and a lot of people felt, was central to the reason why this art form has died. Because if you, if any part of a culture is the exclusion of new faces, like, you're just setting yourself up to, for it to dwindle and decay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I feel like I spent like the entire rest of that decade kind of looking for something that I could get into, as much as I was into indie rock, like towards the end of the aughts, just kind of something small that I could, like I said, call my own. But I never really got into anything as much as I did this kind of specific scene and genre of music.
I think I found albums that I got into on that level, but never a scene, like you said. I never found a movement that I felt like I was excited to be a part of.
This was definitely, it felt like the climax and somewhat end of an era as well.
Definitely. Can we look at Twitter that night, though? Because Twitter was wild that night.
Everybody was shocked that this happened. I mean, the first thing that Win Butler said when he accepted the trophy was, "What the hell?" And then immediately after the award show, Arcade Fire got on Twitter and tweeted in all caps, "Oh my God, oh 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 my God. Thank you, everyone."
Who do you think that was?
I bet it was Win.
That would be my guess.
Maybe I think it could have been his brother too, Will. Because, you know, he's always seemed like a quirky guy dancing around on stage banging whatever he can get his hands on.
And I could totally see Win telling Will, like, "You handle the Twitter."
Yeah.
Additionally, if we're talking about Twitter, we got to talk about Kanye West, America's darling.
Everyone's favorite award show attendee and commentator.
Who also tweeted about the band's win, who he posted, hashtag Arcade Fire, there is hope, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. I feel like we all won when something like this happens, all caps, fucking awesome.
Not everybody was as thrilled about the upset as Kanye, though, because like in the wake of the win, Twitter and Facebook and all kinds of other social media sites were flooded with like confused posts from people who had never heard of the band The Suburbs and were angry that their album Arcade Fire had beaten records by Eminem and Lady Gaga.
And I think today, 2010, feels more like Lady Gaga's year than it feels like Arcade Fire's year, doesn't it?
I don't know. I definitely, like I said, I think this Grammy win was a big moment. Like, I still associate 2010 very much with Arcade Fire. Not as much as I do with albums like My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy or something, but in terms of rock records, this definitely feels like one of the biggest.
Now, you might think that these angry tweets from Eminem and Lady Gaga stans are lost to the sands of time, but fortunately, they are immortalized because there is a still existing Tumblr, who is arcadefire.tumblr.com, that kind of gathered, compendiumed all of these befuddled tweets.
Still a lot of fun to go through in 2022. Do you want to read a couple of them?
Yeah, let's do a few.
So one of my favorites was, like this one is just like really representative of the entire lot of them. "The Grammy people have lost their mind. Who are The Suburbs and how in the heck did they win Album of the Year?"
"Arcade Fire? This is bullshit. So what if they are Canadian? They aren't Eminem."
Another good one. "How can this group get Album of the Year when they didn't even have as many top tens as Lady Gaga? this group even have a number one hit?
Lol at all the nobodies at the Grammys. Arcade Fire? I'm sorry, it should have won the stupid name award. Listen.
That guy really got him.
Listen. I can't disagree that the Arcade Fire are not Eminem. I mean, they got us dead to rights on that one.
It's a fact.
Okay, if everything that comes after is sort of a step down, then let's kind of look at these last 10 years in the wake of The Suburbs. How about?
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to be speculating on whether or not these albums are going to get a 10 upon reissue, I think it's important to look at what the band has been up to since and how that has impacted, like, public and Pitchfork in general's perception of them.
Okay, so then after that record's kind of promotional cycle cooled down, they had a very high-profile stint as the backing band of Mick Jagger on an episode of Saturday Night Live. What's up with all these weird cosigns, right? Like, Bowie, that makes sense. U2, I kind of get. Mick Jagger, so weird.
Yeah, I don't remember this happening either.
Do you remember the single that they made for the Hunger Games?
I do remember them putting out a single for the Hunger Games soundtrack.
That was, everybody had to. It was the law.
They were like the Twilight soundtracks of their days.
Definitely. The band did unveil plans, though, to release a fourth album late in 2013, and anticipation for that album, Trevor, only increased when it was announced that James Murphy would be producing, making the record his first high-profile project kind of since the disbandment of his platinum-selling group LCD Sound System. So all eyes were on this release.
I definitely remember that announcement and feeling very hyped for it.
It felt like, oh my god, like two of the most visionary minds in indie rock coming together to make this huge blockbuster album.
And I think something I do remember feeling about The Suburbs, as much as I liked it, was that Arcade Fire were kind of ripe for reinvention, and James Murphy really seemed like a good guy to kind of get these guys dancing, if you will.
A new producer, at least, was a smart step.
Mm-hmm. So Reflector was eventually released on October 28th, 2013. It earned the band another number one on the Billboard Hot 100, and it received generally favorable, if not universally glowing, reviews. Critics praised the record for pushing the band's sound in a more rhythm-forward and danceable direction, which, of course, was a move widely credited to the influence of James Murphy.
Although, of course, Wynn kind of maintained that this new stylistic shift was due to the visits that he and Regine had been taking to the latter's home country of Haiti. But, you know, there were some common kind of negs against Reflector. I mean, it's a 75-minute long album. It spans two CDs, and criticism tended to focus on bloat. A lot of the tracks kind of exceed that 6-minute mark, and some critics complained that the material kind of overstayed its welcome and expressed a desire for more vigorous self-editing.
You take a look at The Suburbs, and that's already a very long record. I feel like sometimes there's the instinct to kind of pare down after that and go for a more simplistic approach. So in some ways, you kind of got a respect for them going even bigger and going for like two whole discs.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. I mean, I did go back to Reflector, Trevor, and listen to it again, and I liked the record more than I remembered liking it. I think that there's some good material on it. It definitely doesn't feel like major in my brain.
No. I mean, I'll still go to bat for that record, but definitely doesn't like invoke the same feelings in me as Funeral or The Suburbs does.
The
Pitchfork, though, remained firmly in the band's corner. They gave Reflector a rating of 9.2, which is their highest since Funeral. And they said that Arcade Fire has given us something in the present tense that these days feels depressingly unfashionable. An event, an album that dares to be great and remarkably succeeds. And they would later, at the end of the year, also rank the album as the 10th best record of 2013.
Yeah, I can't get that excited about it, I don't think.
I don't know if it's above a 9 for me.
Very good drum sound, though. I do think James did his job kind of bringing a new sound to the record.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, they definitely needed something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then, aside from the debut of a new song during a surprise set outside of the Louvre in 2016... things remained quiet in the Arcade Fire camp until 2017, when the band released its latest record to date, Everything Now.
This is a polarizing and controversial record.
It's bathed in controversy.
Even its promotional cycle was super controversial. Like, the band adopted a really ironic and comedic tone, not unlike the kind of vibe that U2 went for with, like, Achtung Baby and Zooropa.
This is a major U2 parallel of, like...
It's a big U2
yeah,
parallel.
Yeah, going all in on kind of irony and about consumerism specifically. It's very Bono, this record.
They made frequent use of guerrilla marketing and alternate reality game-like elements.
Could you imagine that just, like, in 2020, if Arcade Fire was, like, they got an ARG? There's an Arcade Fire ARG.
Yeah, no thanks. Not really something I'm looking for when it comes to this
band. What were the shenanigans? Okay, so the video of the first single debuted via a Twitter account that was designed to, like, appear as a Russian spam bot. And the track list got announced as a series of anagrams that you had to unscramble. And then there was kind of like a backstory for the album that was like unfolding across different social media platforms. And it was all focused on... this partnership between the band and like an unscrupulous corporate entity called the Everything Now Corporation. And they would like announce fake licensing deals. Like they had a branded Arcade Fire fidget spinner that I don't think you could actually buy. And also there was like a fictional Rock Band Arcade Fire edition ad, which I know for certain you can't actually buy. That was definitely made up. And you know, this like experimental, like tongue in cheek, marketing approach, it did kind of remain true to the album's like main themes of anti-capitalism and like consumerism and artistic prostitution, but that it didn't go down very easily, Trevor. It didn't go down easily.
It really landed with a thud for a lot of people. Although, you know what? Personally, I think that was one of the strongest things about Everything Now. I think it's a great late stage capitalism record.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to the idea of fun and games. I just think that maybe the problem was that it didn't pair nicely with Wynn's kind of like super austere and serious image. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and in particular, the blogs were just not here for it. I think Complex called it, all in all, a bizarre and insufferable experience.
And that was in a news story. Yeah. And the record itself was co-produced by Thomas Bangalter of Daft Punk. It released on July 28th, 2017. The title of the record was Everything Now. And unfortunately, the music seemed to fare about as well as the rollout. I mean, they kind of fell out of favor. They were critical darlings no longer, Arcade Fire.
Yeah, it got like, what, a 66 on Metacritic? Critics mainly called it like half-baked, gratuitously moralizing, dull, and even Pitchfork issued the album a damning score of 5.6, with reviews editor Jeremy Larson characterizing Everything Now as a tangled, joyless record of Banksy disco and bloodless new wave.
It is kind of the recording album equivalent of a fucking Banksy stencil of like a rat holding a Game Boy or something.
Yeah, I mean, they get points for trying, but like the execution just could have been better.
I listened to that record for the very first time yesterday, Trevor, and I gotta say I did not like it very much. I was kind of like hoping to discover a little slept on gem, but yeah, it didn't really do much for me.
There are tracks on it that I enjoy, but I don't find myself reaching for it very frequently.
Well, with the conclusion of Everything Now's promotional cycle, Arcade Fire went quiet once more, popping back up in 2019 to record a cover of Baby Mine for the Disney live-action remake of Dumbo, which, I mean, yeah. Look, when your last album was kind of hinged on lecturing the people and your fellow artists against greed and corporatization of art, like, that seems like it's maybe a little inconsistent to then run out and do the Disney Dumbo remake credit song.
You kind of expect more self-awareness from these indie bands.
Yeah,
than that.
But hey, gotta pay the fucking bills, man. You gotta pay the bills.
And yeah, like you said, they've been pretty quiet since then. But in April of this year, Wynn dropped the first hints at the new Arcade Fire record. He said that apparently the band was a few months into recording new material when the coronavirus outbreak hit, and that the material they'd been exploring had a lot of lyrical and musical themes that felt almost eerily related to what is happening now. He concluded by saying, needless to say, the writing has intensified and the work is flowing out. It is challenging as ever and with just as much purpose.
So he's still pot committed, man. Wynn still believes in the Arcade Fire, so perhaps we should too.
I think I do, Dylan. I think I like I said, I like you too. I feel like they could overcome this nadir in popularity and really push out something that does resonate with at least their fan base again. I don't know if, like you said, I don't know if we're ever going to get another album that's as big as a sensation as Funeral or The Suburbs, but I think they could turn in some good work in the future.
Yeah, I think that, like, you know, examining the band's career, I wouldn't describe Wynn Butler as like a wholly lovable and unirritating character, but I'm not rooting against the comeback. I mean, The Suburbs is a fucking great album. It'd be sick if we just got another record with like really good hooks and good writing and like a...
just some solid workmanship, like indie rock shit. Come on, guys, you could do it.
Yeah, give us like some good work around theme without super adherence to a big concept. I think would be a good move. You know.
Yeah, you don't need to disappear up your own ass and create a fictional inscrupulous corporation. We have enough of those already.
Yeah, if anything, like just fucking tell me where to click the thing and here's the thing, and that's all you got to do at this point, right?
Let's talk about what the future has in store for The Suburbs specifically, though, because we've reached the point in the episode where you and I are going to bet 10 real dollars on whether or not we think this album is going to get a perfect 10 from Pitchfork should they review it in the future when it gets reissued or whatever.
Okay, well,
which it inevitably will.
Can we inform that with a little bit of discussion around what the feelings about The Suburbs have kind of come to in the intervening years?
Please.
Because I did a little research on this. I wanted to look specifically at, like, you know, end of decade rankings and overall, like, best album rankings, and also, like, you know, what kind of user review sites were saying about this record. And I think that there's some illumination to be gotten from that. I went to Best Ever Albums, which kind of aggregates a bunch of different critics' lists and spits out a kind of combined one. They ranked The Suburbs as the number 2 best Arcade Fire album behind Funeral. I think that checks out. It has appeared in 1,625 published lists year-end, decade, and all time. And it is ranked as the number 2 best album of 2010 behind My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which probably actually deserved album of the year that year. Pitchfork, of course, ranked it as the 11th best album of 2010, as we mentioned before. It is ranked as the number 3 best album of the 2010s, so that's fucking big. Also just behind My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy at number 2. And it's ranked as the number 36th best album of all time, behind Who's Next by The Who. We're talking top 50 albums of all time, according to the aggregate view of music journalists, so that's pretty big, right?
High praise.
And then let's look at Rate Your Music, because I want to get an ear on the ground and hear what Joe Average has to say. Average user review score of 3.67 out of 5, so not like, you know, explosive.
Respectable.
It's ranked as the 3rd best Arcade Fire album on that website behind Neon Bible and Funeral. I definitely have heard some similar views from some big Arcade Fire stands as seeing Neon Bible as the other masterpiece. I don't know that I can go there with them, though. They ranked it as the number 4 best album of 2010, just behind Have One On Me by Joanna Newsom, another great record. They ranked it as the 404th best album of all time behind Noi by Noi, which, you know, a little bit more modest there. The top rated tracks, now this, I wonder if this checks out with the ones that you love, Trevor. We've got Sprawl 2 at number 1 with a 4.5 out of 5.
Best new track, according to Pitchfork.
Yep. We got The Suburbs at 4.4 out of 5 at number 2.
A good title track, for sure.
And we got Ready to Start at 4.3 out of 5 at number 3.
I believe that was the song they played immediately upon winning that Grammy, right?
Yeah. I think it was wasn't it out at the time or something? I can't remember exactly how that worked out promotionally. And the bottom-rated track is a tie between Wasted Hours with a 3.5 and Sprawl 1 with a 3.5. That certainly matches up with Critical's assessment. I don't hate Sprawl 1. I don't think it's bad.
I think Sprawl 1 is okay. I really actually like Wasted Hours quite a bit. There are two tracks on this album that I've always really been drawn to that weren't the big successful singles, and that is Wasted Hours and Modern Man.
For some reason,
I can always just put those two songs on. They weren't big hits at the time. Like, I didn't see them get a lot of play, but I think they've really stood the test of time for me.
I want to read a couple of reviews for you. This is the top-rated positive review from user Jay Chopa on Rate Your Music, who said, "I very deeply relate to this album. I am part of a generation that has grown up in a weirdly plastic suburban environment, numbed by mass media. The kids of the 60s grew up in the same environment, but they protested and rebelled. They spoke out." So, going way out on a limb there to say, like, we're no boomers. We're not as cool as those boomers were. And then the top-rated negative review from user Panda08, much more to the point, says, "Sometimes I sort of enjoy this, but then I start paying more attention to the lyrics, and it's just like, dude, what are you going on about?"
He's talking about the suburbs, dude. It's right there in the album title.
I think that's pretty good. I like both of those poll quotes.
But Dylan, what do you and I think about how this album is going to stand the test of time going into the future? If it is reissued and Pitchfork decides to review it again, will they bump up that score to a perfect 10?
Because that's the thing, right? Like, it's very seldom that a record gets a 10 out of 10 from Pitchfork on its initial review. It's much more common that a 10 is handed out on a reissue or on a classic album Sunday. And so I think... And of course, the reason is, and I think that's legitimate. I think it's legitimate to say it's easier to see an album's importance in the rear view than it is when it first comes across your desk. I don't think that I can't begrudge them for that. I think that's fair.
Hindsight is 20/20, but we're here to talk about 10s.
Good point.
And Dylan, let me tell you, I don't think that every album we talk about on this show is going to get a 10 upon its re-review, but I feel pretty confident that next time we see a review of The Suburbs pop up on Pitchfork, it's going to be accompanied by a little red 10 and a little red circle. So confident that I'm willing to bet you $10.
A crisp new Alexander Hamilton on the table, huh?
There you go. What are you going to do with that?
Here's the thing, Trevor. I think that if The Suburb gets a 10, it means a lot more than The Suburbs is a masterpiece album. I think that The Suburbs getting a 10 means a lot semiotically about whether or not indie rock was an important and special form. I think that the staff giving that record a 10 on reissue is in a way saying we were right about that whole decade and that movement, and it has its classics and it deserves to be reckoned with as an important release in the pantheon of great albums. And I'm not going with you on this one, man. I'm gonna say no. I here's my prediction. I predict that they give with one hand and take with the other and go with a cop out of like a 9.8.
I could see it happening, but like we talked about, this was a really defining moment for this whole movement as a whole. And I think even if it does, if the movement doesn't end up being as historically significant or popular as it was at the time, I think they are still going to hold this album up as a symbol of like what that moment in time was like. And like, if even if we're not going to be holding that moment up, at least we can take this album from it. And that's why I think it still has a chance of getting one.
And that's fair, right? Because that exists too. Like, people don't give a fuck about Madchester anymore, but they still talk about the Stone Roses and the Happy Mondays.
Exactly.
So why can't indie rock just be one of those? A thing that while you were inside of it, it felt like the next big moment in music. And now maybe in hindsight is a little bit silly, but Arcade Fire can still be their poster child. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And something that I think a role that we might see this album fill in the future is maybe you don't need to listen to all those old indie rock records that used to get great reviews on the site, but there's always going to be like a spot for this one just because of how big it was and how important it was at the time.
Definitely, definitely.
And like we touched on earlier, I think in the future, music journalists are still going to have a lot of the same warm feelings about this record as they did when it came out. You know, even if Arcade Fire has kind of slipped out of their good graces for the time being, I think there's always going to be a lot of love for this record.
They haven't slipped out of graces in a way that invalidates any of their classics. You know what I mean? Like, they haven't shown that the formula was flawed. They just haven't lived up to the early, you know, universal hit stuff.
Right, right.
Hey, the suburbs, we did it. We had a retrospective. We understand its place in our culture now, and we've pretty much decided what the future holds for this record. I feel like we're the authorities on this now.
Oh, I think we definitely are. But I would still like to encourage anyone listening to reach out to us and let us know what they think about The Suburbs by Arcade Fire. If you'd like us to read out your thoughts and opinions on the next episode, maybe, you can write to us at pre10pod@gmail.com. That's the number 10, pre10pod. And find us on Twitter at pre10pod.
So reach out to us on there if you have any questions about the show. You can always find Trevor online on Twitter at TRVRKRTH, which is Trevor Ickrath, with the vowels all taken out, sucked out of them with a vacuum cleaner.
Very Pitchfork indie band move, I might say myself.
P4K Turverkirth.
And you can find Dylan on Twitter at Dylan Flynn.
Yeah, nothing special there. I just went with moniker. What are we going to do next time? I think we should try to keep this to like roughly once a month, right? Look back on the big releases of the month. That seems a way to do it.
Well, then how about we reconvene in September to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of Halcyon Digest by Deer Hunter, originally released on September 28, 2010.
I like to imagine that like a chunk of our audience is going like, fuck yeah, that record was my jam. And another chunk is going, who are Halcyon Digest and what is their album Deer Hunter about?
One can only hope.